Welcome to the Buckeye Battle Cry Radio Hour, coming at you across the web with the most exciting interviews and the best in Ohio State football and basketball coverage. Here's your host, Joe Dexter.
What is up, Buckeye Nation? Hello and welcome to the Buckeye Battle Cry Radio Hour, the show that finds itself amongst the company of an Ohio State legend today. I'm Joe Dexter, excited to be joined with the man who's fifth all-time in career points at Ohio State and in the record books, second in school history, behind his teammate Herb Williams in career field goals made, as we are joined by Kelvin Ranzi. Kelvin, how's it going today?
Wonderful. Good to be on the phone with you today.
We're glad to have you. A great story. You start in the NBA. You're drafted in 1980 at the age of 27. You walked away from the game to choose another dream, becoming a leader in ministry and a great career with Ohio State, one that goes overlooked at times. Let's start right there. You talk about Ohio State and your career there. It's an interesting one because sometimes people forget how important in basketball it is when you start a ground level. You got to have that ground level to get to the championships, and you were part of rebuilding the Ohio State basketball program.
Exactly. When I came in, the program was pretty down. Coach Taylor had just retired, and Eldon Miller had taken over, and I saw a great opportunity to play for a great school, although I knew it was down. But if I could do what I thought I could do, then I knew it was going to do me well. And it worked out just like I thought.
You played at Macomber, and you look at Toledo Products and what they've done at Ohio State. It's impressive, and you helped start some of that. And one thing that I look at, and you look at that City League, and that has to get you ready for college basketball.
It does. Of course, when I played in the city, it was Truman Clater, Terry Crosby. These guys were great players and just prepared us for the next level.
You get ready to head to Ohio State. When you look at recruiting in college basketball, it's one of the more interesting things, recruiting in general. How did your recruiting go, and how were you convinced that Ohio State was the place to be?
Well, actually, it was between Ohio State, Toledo, and Michigan State. I really liked Jay Heupel, and I really considered going there. But the thing that wound me over with Ohio State was, first of all, it was Coach Eldon Miller. I really liked his approach, and his assistant coaches, I liked their approach also. But I also liked the fact that it was Big Ten, and I thought I could play in the Big Ten. So that's what really swayed me over at the end.
How much of your life has consisted of proving people wrong? It seems like one thing that leads to success in this world is believing in yourself, and you've definitely had that throughout your career in the NBA. You have it now as a minister. How much did that play in the fact of wanting to be in the Big Ten is, hey, I can do this?
Well, I think you know, you got to have that confidence that you can play. You know, I knew I had talent, you know, but it was just the confidence. Playing in the City League against the great players I played against convinced me that I thought I could play on a pretty high level. So, again, that kind of swayed me, although the program wasn't really great at the time. That's the one thing that swayed me was that I know it was a big program.
So your first year is also the first year for head coach Eldon Miller. You step into the program as a freshman and get some major playing time. That squad goes 9-18. When you look back at your freshman year, it seemed to propel the rest of your career. Was there a player on that squad that helped you get to the next level, to the college level, and get you ready for your sophomore season?
Probably, yeah. Probably more than anybody was Larry Bowden. Larry was the captain that year, and he was also a point guard. And I was fluctuating between point guard and shooting guard as a freshman, and Larry just kind of took me under his wing, and I learned so much from Larry, just watching him play, watch how he approached the game, and it really helped me. He was a key factor to how good I was.
What's the biggest transition you have to make as a human being, even just going into the college basketball world and going to the college level? It's one thing, even if you're just a student, but to add the student athlete to it, I imagine it's a big transition.
It was. I think the biggest transition was nobody was going to make you go to school, you know. You, in high school, you had to go. You know, you got absences, and of course, it affected your grade. So, but in college, you was on your own, and no one made you go. So it really increased the discipline part. You had to want to go. And that was the biggest change for me.
You guys head into your sophomore year. You have a 16-11 record, and you finish 500 in the Big Ten. What were some of the things you guys worked on heading into that sophomore year, for you especially, taking over and running the point?
Well, one thing I wanted to do, of course, was to get better each year. I had some great games as a freshman, so that really gave me confidence that I could play in the league. And I think with the recruiting that we had that year, we got Herb Williams, Jim Smith, Kenny Page, and some other great players. That was beginning the upswing of the basketball program, I think.
What was it like playing with Herb Williams? I mean, that had to be special.
Herb was an awesome, awesome player. I used to go to his games. I mean, when he played at Marion Franklin, and I was in the recruiting process, and I used to go to his games, and I was always telling him, that's my next center. You know, he's going to be with me. And he was just phenomenal, phenomenal player. And another one that doesn't get the recognition he deserves, in my opinion.
When you look at your record that sophomore year, and this is a thing that became commonality in your time at Ohio State, you were 11-3 at St. John Arena. And I think and I wasn't there, but I think the plan for you guys and what you guys went into the season thinking is, we have to own St. John Arena to be successful.
Exactly, exactly. In the Big Ten, that was a must anyway. You needed to hold home court because the league was so competitive. If you lost at home, it just hurt. And St. John's turned into a great venue for basketball, you know, in those years, because the people would come and they were close to the court. And it was a challenging place to play for visitors. So we got a great advantage out there.
You definitely put your mark on the court your sophomore year, averaging 35 minutes per game. You had about 18 points per game, I believe, and you were able to get to the basketball, 53 steals on the season. When you look back at your Big Ten career and you look back at some of the guys you played with in the conference, it's impressive when you look at the guys that were in the Big Ten at that time. Who is one of the tougher guys for you to guard, or maybe one of the players that stuck out in your mind?
I really think people don't understand how awesome it was at that time. Because you're talking Magic Johnson, you're talking Isaiah Thomas, Ronnie Lester, Michael Thompson. I mean, it was just unbelievable every time you hit the floor. So a lot of those guys went on to play pro and make Hall of Fame, you know, Kevin McHale. And so it was a real challenging league. But one of the hardest players I had to play against was Ronnie Lester. I think he would have been probably one of the best to play if he hadn't had the knee injury. He was a great player.
Great coaches as well inside the conference, and just a great time for Big Ten basketball. People talk about it being one of the tops now. It was one of the tops then, too.
Yes, it was. It was. Unbelievable. I mean, we couldn't go anywhere. You couldn't go to Wisconsin, because they had Wes Matthews and different players of that caliber. You just couldn't go anywhere and just relax. You had to play every night you played.
You shift into your junior season where, again, starting and on the squad, you're one of the co-captains. You look at your junior season, and it always seems that, like, something changes between players when they are young and getting into that junior year. Is there anything? Do you look at the game different when you get to that point of your college career?
Well, you begin to understand, you know, you didn't play 2 years in one of the best conferences in the nation, or the best, I think, in the nation. So now you begin to get a feel of what it's going to be like every night. So your mentality changes, and all of a sudden you're marked also, because our program increased. So now we're no longer the ones hunting. We're being the hunted ones. So it was just a whole total shift in the mindset of myself and our players. We had to bring it.
You look back and you make the NIT that junior year. A lot of special things happened that season. Is there anything that sticks out to you?
The junior year, I thought we started out great that year. I think we won our first 8 games in the Big Ten, if I'm not mistaken. We were really on the roll. And I don't know exactly what happened that year. We seemed like we lost confidence. I remember going into Michigan State. We was 8-0. That's and we got there and thought we could get a win because Magic got hurt. But Magic ended up coming back, doing a Willis Reed on us, you know. And really hurt us. And when we lost that game, we kind of went on a downward spiral. And but that year, I thought we overachieved. I thought we were doing better than most people thought.
You averaged 21 points, 4 assists, and adding more to the steals, 54 steals. It's impressive when you look at what you were able to do in Ohio State, and you're not recognized at some of the level as some of the other guys that have made their name in the conference like you have and have made their name as Ohio State players. As a junior, that was the second time you were named All Big Ten Conference. Does it bug you a little bit that you're not recognized as the player you were at Ohio State sometimes?
Well, you know, sometimes I think about it because, to be truthful, you know, I was one of the main ones to help, and I don't boast on my brag. I'm just blessed. I was blessed to be able to play the game. But I surely was one of the best players there, I believe, and set many records there. So sometimes it does get me a little bit. But then I realize, you know, I'm doing what I want to do. I had a great career, so there's nothing really to complain about.
Coach Miller's first 21 season came with your senior season, and you guys really stepped it up and made it to the next level where everybody wants to be in college basketball. It's March Madness. You guys got a chance to take on a really good team in UCLA, just falling a little bit short in that ball game. But your performance in that game is something that a lot of Ohio State fans remember.
Yes. Wow, I was so excited. I was so excited to be in the NCAA. You know, of course, that was a dream, you know. And so when we got there, you know, I played at a high level. I don't know what happened. It was like I know I played the best I played that season. And it was like an adrenaline kicked in, and I said, this is it. We got a chance to do something special. And so I can remember just the feeling of being in the tournament, you know, even though we had to go to Arizona State and play Arizona State on their home court in the NCAA, and we were the fourth seed.
How does a Big Ten season get you ready for something like that? I mean, because you enter the March Madness and you already have been prepared for taking on whatever could be faced by your guys as long as everybody stays healthy. I mean, that's something that it goes unwritten, is just getting that confidence and built up to the season. That's a key part of March Madness.
Oh, it is. It is. You know, it's the mental, the preparation. We were definitely talented enough to win the whole thing, I thought. We had a couple of unfortunate things happen during that time. So I remember distinctly after we won the first game, we flew back to Columbus, I think, for one day of school, and then we had to fly back out to Arizona. And I think that had an effect on us. I really do.
Kelvin Ranzi joining us here on the Buckeye Battle Cry Radio Hour, one of Ohio State's greats on the hardwood at point guard. Kelvin, when you look at point guards today and you look at point guards throughout history, there's been some great ones at Ohio State and there's been some great ones in the Big Ten. The one thing that I wonder from you, being a point guard, what's the one thing that you need to have success at the college level, being a signal caller and being that quarterback on the court?
I think it's one thing you have to do. The first thing you have to do is know your personnel. You have to know where your players can best execute their gifts. You know, so I learned every one of our players. I knew where Herb wanted the ball. I knew where Jim could get the ball. I knew where not to give it to him. You know, Carter Scott, I knew he was a great 15-foot shooter, so I would make sure he got to that point. It's just knowing your personnel, knowing when to pass it, when to shoot it. One thing that I did, and people don't understand, is going into my senior year, I had the ability to really be the all-time leading scorer. I had the chance to. But Clark came in, so I really decreased my scoring in order to be more of a conventional point guard. So that really helped me in the long run, although I probably could have ended up the all-time lead scorer.
That's the one thing people really don't understand about the point guard position, too, is it's a lot of sacrifice, but it's not sacrifice in a way because it's a willing sacrifice. You want to win, and you got to want to win and do the right thing in order to play point guard.
You really do. You know, I averaged 21 points the year before, and I came back in, and again, we got carved, and we had a well-rounded team, so I ended up averaging like 16 or 17, but I did beat the Big Ten in assists that year. So, again, I think it helped. It goes all the way back to high school when my coach, I was really the dominant player in the city, basically, and I would score 25 points in the first half of games, and at halftime, he'd come in and tell me that I'll leave you in the second half, but you can't shoot. And I would be, what are you doing? I can't, I mean, I could get 40, 50, you know, I could score big, but he was teaching me a valuable lesson. You got to do more than score. So I ended up averaging almost a triple-double in high school my senior year.
Kelvin Ranzi with us on the Buckeye Battle Cry Radio Hour as we talk about his Ohio State career. What's your biggest memory on the floor being an Ohio State Buckeye?
Well, I think one of the greatest memories I can recall is that I remember us playing Minnesota. I think it was my junior year, and we had never beaten Minnesota. They had Michael Thompson and Kevin McHale, and they just seemed to own us. And I believe that they were ranked second in the nation or very high in the nation. This was our last chance to beat them, and I really wanted to beat them. And I remember coming out there, and it was an overtime game, and we ended up beating them in overtime. And so that was one of my greatest games, one of my greatest thrills being there because, again, we were going to the national championship. So that was a great win. Also, I remember also beating Duke in Madison Square Garden, which Duke was ranked number one. And we came back from 17 down to win that game in overtime. But the only thing, it was overshadowed by Woody Hayes that same night who hit the football player. So our story got second page. But it was a great game.
Man, you look back, and I know that you played at Madison Square Garden as a professional a couple times, but being that age and walking onto Madison Square Garden, that had to be a dream come true.
It was because my idols playing was Walt Frazier and Earl Monroe. I watched them all the time. And then when I heard we were going to Madison Square Garden, it was like, wow, are you kidding me? And I think we ended up playing at Madison Square Garden. I know we played the NIT there, and then we played a Christmas tournament there. My average at Madison Square Garden was like 29 points a game. It was unbelievable. It's like when you get on that court, it's just like, wow, this is it.
That's something you hang your hat on, man. That's just you look at the places where basketball is king. The Mecca is Madison Square Garden. So to be able to play at that level has got to be, you know, to you, one of the career highlights.
It was, and we lost that championship game at Rutgers, and I had my career high there at 38 points. And I remember thinking years later, I said, we had the three-point line at that time, I probably would have had about 50 or 60, because I can remember being really on fire that night. But again, we didn't have the three-point line. So the accomplishments that I did really deserve a lot more credit because we didn't have that.
Absolutely. Your accomplishments took you to the NBA. You're drafted in 1980, drafted fourth overall by the Bulls, traded to Portland. You end up playing in Portland and then being traded to Dallas. But as we look at that NBA career, the first thing that I look at, man, is that 1980 NBA draft. You look at the list of guys on there, and I just like to look at anomalies. And I found this interesting. In that class,
right,
you were drafted fourth. Kevin McHale was
right.
Drafted in that draft. Larry Drew was as well, all with coaching
mm-hmm.
experience. Mike Woodson, assistant for the Clippers now, he was with
right.
the Knicks for a long time. Do you see that when you have that point guard position, you look at all those anomalies, and I look at you in the same position. I mean, because you stepped away from the game after 6 years. You're teaching and coaching every day in your profession as a pastor. Do you think your playing
exactly.
career prepared you for being the pastor that you are today?
Oh, without question, because it taught me how to be a leader, you know, and I always thrived on being a leader. And, you know, and I don't know how many people realize this, even when I played with Portland, that my first year there, I was one vote from Rookie of the Year. And most people said I should have won it. And the only reason I didn't win it, I believe, because I'd had very little exposure, and Daryl Griffith was more of a flashy type of player, and I think they thought they could market him more. But if you look at our stats that year, he didn't make the playoffs. We did. You know, I was the highest-scoring rookie in the league. And back then, they didn't have players of the week like they did now. They only had players of the month. So I was the only rookie to win player of the month that whole year. So, you know, I understood the game. I could play the point guard position, and it taught me how to lead and to know what to do at the right time. So it definitely helped me in my passing. No doubt about it.
You hate to look back sometimes, but if you were to look back and say maybe you stayed in the NBA like some of these guys like Larry Drew, Kevin McHale stayed in the NBA throughout years and years and still are there, do you see yourself in that list of possible guys that could have gotten to coaching?
I know I could have coached. In fact, sometimes I still dream about coaching because I really have a knowledge of the game. Sometimes I'm watching, I'm saying, what are you doing? And I can see things even before it happened. And I said, if I was the coach, I would do this. And I always did want to coach. But, you know, the Lord had me to go another way. So I'm coaching in another arena. But that was always one of my desires to coach basketball.
You said you noticed when people are making mistakes on the court, and you look at the NBA today, and I know one thing that you were known for, especially with the Trailblazers, was getting to the rack and making sure that the bucket falls. I mean, you talked about not having the three-point line back in the day, too, but I think that's missing from today's game in a way, where players, especially point guards, are sometimes afraid to get to the hole.
Again, yeah, I again refer to the fact that I think I played in the greatest era of basketball ever, even in the Big Ten and in the NBA, from the 80 to 86 era. I played against some of the greatest. You know, you're talking Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, Larry Bird, Julius Erving, Magic, a lot of the Hall of Famers, a lot of the top 50 of all times was in that era. And what I found out in that era that you don't see now, you only see it with teams like San Antonio, is that how they move the ball. And basketball is a beautiful game. And when I played for Jack Ramsey, he was the greatest mind on the basketball court that I ever played for. His knowledge of movement, he really created that way before Popovich did. Jack Ramsey created the movement off his pass, cut, pass, pick. It was beautiful. And I really thrived in that. I love that offense. And you rarely see that now.
You rarely do. And you had a really good chemistry with your backcourt mate and Jim Paxson. And you look back at what Coach Ramsey built for the Trailblazers. Is he your favorite coach you ever played for in the NBA?
He was, as far as knowledge of the game. But one thing about me, if you coached me, the best way to get the best out of me was not to holler at me or scream at me, but to teach me. And that's what he did with me. He wasn't a screamer. He wasn't a cursor or a yeller, but he was a great teacher. And so he would tell me, this is why this didn't work, Kelvin. You got to do this. And I learned a lot of the game just from him teaching. And I think that's what's missing a lot in today's game. Everybody wants to be athletic, and you see more dunking and more flashy things. But as far as the fundamentals, you look at Magic and Larry, they set the bar for passing, you know, and John Stockton, they set the bar for passing and getting it through. That's beautiful basketball to watch.
So you spend a couple of years in Portland, then you head to Dallas. You get to that point in your career and you're blossoming. Things are going great in Portland. And then you're traded to Dallas where your minutes were cut a bit and things just didn't seem to go the way that a young player needs that kind of structure where he can build up on what he's learning and build up on the experience he's getting. Is that at the point where you thought after you did play six seasons, but you start thinking maybe this isn't the career for me?
Yeah, and looking back on it now, I understand that this was a thing that, in my opinion, the Lord was doing with my life. He was getting me to places where I didn't want to play. You know, I had as much talent as any guard in the league, and I thought at Portland we really had a championship-caliber team if we would have built around myself, Jimmy, Michael Thompson, and Calvin Natt, Kermit Washington. We had a great core group, but for some reason, you know, they get panicked and where we need to make some changes. And at that time, Jack was getting a little older, you know, and rest in peace, Jack. He was a great coach, but I think he began to lose his passion for the game. And so I think they made some moves that they shouldn't have made. Nevertheless, you know, I understand it now as a move of God, because every team I went to, of course, I played less, and I began to lose my love of the game, which in turn, you know, pushed me to where I am today.
I got to imagine, though, after Dallas, you go to New Jersey. At the age of 27, when you decided to walk away from the game, even with God pulling you away from the game, that's got to be hard as a 27-year-old to say goodbye to what has become a lifelong dream.
It was. It was very difficult. You know, it was probably the most difficult decision I ever made, because when I quit playing, I was only 27 years old. And I was really in the prime of my basketball career. And as far as finances were concerned, the NBA was just getting ready to go into another level of finances. So with all that being said and looked at, I understood that it had to be a call of God. I left on my own terms. I didn't leave because I was hurt. I didn't leave because I didn't love the game. I left because I felt I had a higher calling, a greater calling than basketball.
It's a different league now than it was then, but how hard was it then to be a man of God in the NBA?
Oh, it was very difficult. The temptations and everything that's offered to you being in the NBA, the status, you know, all that makes it very tempting to do things that, you know, you shouldn't do. But I have to give credit to my upbringing and my family. My father was a great godly man, and he died in 1982, but he did get to see me play in the NBA a couple of years before he passed. But what a great example of godliness. And my mother also, she's still alive, not doing well right now, but she's still alive. And they just put such a foundation of God in us that I knew which way I was going to go not too long after I got into the NBA.
That being said, and people always say, you know, your world becomes the people you surround yourself around. So if you surround yourself around great people, great things are going to happen and those types of things. But I still imagine that you took flack from some of the close people around you for leaving the game.
Oh, I did. You know, people saying, are you serious? And I said, yes, I got to do this. They said, But it's just getting ready to explode. I said, well, it's a calling on my life to do what God wants me to do. You know, it caused a lot of tension in my family and friendships. And I really found out who my real friends were when that happened. Because when you have status, you have friends. But when all that's gone, you find out who really likes you for you. And so I made some great friends during that time who are still friends with me now. But, of course, you find out others who weren't friends.
Kelvin Ransey joining us here on the Buckeye Battle Cry Radio Hour in Ohio State. Great NBA player for the Trailblazers, Mavericks, and New Jersey Nets. How hard was it when you look at the NBA and you look at your retirement? You said your heart wasn't in the game, and when you walk away and all the flack, you put that all together. How hard do you believe that you have to? I mean, being in your position, the pull there is just so strong that it has to be what you were meant to be, what you are today.
Yeah, it was, and that's what it was in my life. I think it was a calling, you know. I hear, even when I look back over my career and I look at some of the things that people said about me, they said I was lazy, and they said that I didn't really have a passion for the game. I did, you know, even in my career, even during the 6 years, as years went down, if you look at my stats, I averaged double figures in the NBA, which not a whole lot of players did. And I ended up playing for some teams that I didn't play a lot. So I know I had the ability to play. I have ever caught on with the right team, which I thought Portland was, but I never did catch on to the right team after that. But again, I think it was a move of God to get me not to love basketball so much, but to love what he called me in to do now. That's what I really believe.
Well, Pastor, if any of those writers or media back there that thought you were lazy, if they're still around and they want to go to YouTube and check out how you perform a sermon, they'll know that you're not lazy. They'll know through that act that you're not lazy. It's getting into rhythm for you, I imagine, on Sunday. Is it much similar to getting into a rhythm as if you were on a floor?
It is. It's preparation, you know. And, of course, you prepare greater for the things that you love, you know. And when I was playing basketball and I was playing a lot and I was at the peak, I was ready every night. You know, I prepared for it mentally and physically. I knew I had the ability to do it, and the love of it was there. But once you lose the love of it, then you don't have quite as much passion for it. And so now, being a minister of the gospel and a preacher, that's where my passion is. So my preparation is based on my passion for what I do. And it's just awesome to see God change people's lives. There's nothing like that. And I couldn't do that playing basketball. In fact, the Lord told me that I was entertaining playing basketball, but now he said, you're enlightening people and changing lives. And you never could have done that playing basketball. So the reward is much greater for me in this field.
Who is the toughest player you guarded in the NBA? Is there one guy that sticks out to you?
Wow. you're talking to NBA, so I had a lot of problems with people like Isaiah. Isaiah Collins was a great guard because he was a scoring guard, so he put pressure on you, you know, all the time coming down. You had to always try to be ready, so he was a tremendous challenge. So was Norm Nixon, who played for the Lakers with Magic, because he was off guard. So Magic was the point guard, so I'm guarding the off guard, going through screens, and so that was very difficult. But then you had people like Gus Williams, Freddie Brown, you know, Walter Davis, Dennis Johnson, and the list goes on. I don't know, every night and stuff.
We're joined with Kelvin Ransey as we talk Ohio State basketball, the NBA, and his career as a minister and preacher. Man, we all go back to things that we know in life as examples to teach, to explain. How much do you go back to basketball in your ministries to show what you're trying to get through the Word of God?
I use it quite often. Especially when I'm dealing with a subject as far as temptation, you know, how to overcome temptation, what I had to overcome. I use an analogy one time that in the NBA, I said I played point guard. So as a point guard, I was a leader. I told people where to go. I told them that if you don't get there, you're not going to get the ball. And so I had to be vocal to be a leader. I said, so at my church, I tell them I'm your point guard. So I tell them I'm the one that directs you, that leads you, through God leading me, who's my coach. I then direct you to better ways to live your life. So I've often used basketball analogies to convey a message.
What do you get more nervous for? Was it starting a game or before a game or before Sunday?
Well, I think it's Sundays. Because, and the reason being, because I understand that I'm trying to speak on behalf of God, you know, to a people, some of them, their very lives are dependent maybe on what you're going to say to them. People come to church often with a need to know how to better their lives, you know, and so there's a sense of awe standing back there as I try to represent God to people who may not know him, to people who know him and may not understand what they're going through. So it's a tremendous mental preparation to get ready to preach every Sunday, which I've been doing now for 29 years.
So fortunate to have Kelvin Ransey here on the Buckeye Battle Cry Radio Hour, the Ohio State great on the hardwood, and now doing great things in life as well, as he has mentioned for the last 20-plus years. Kelvin, want to thank you for joining us here on the program, and as always, go Buckeyes.
Go Buckeyes. You know, I'm still a Buckeye fan. I talk to Brad Molly every once in a while, and I'll be a Buckeye for life. I love Ohio State.
For more on the Buckeye Battle Cry Radio Hour, visit iTunes or check out our media page. For more Buckeye news and notes, visit www.thebuckeyebattlecry.com.